Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hello and welcome to The Election Tricycle, a show about many of the various important elections that are going on in 2024, especially the ones going on in our three countries, the USA, India and the UK. We talk about some of the connections between our countries' systems and elections and some of the differences as well. I'm Tom Hamilton in London and I'm joined by Emily Tamkin in Washington, DC.
Hello.
And Rohan Venkat in Cairo via India.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Yeah, looking at India from this side of the Indian Ocean.
Indeed. And today we're mostly going to be talking about the issue of money in politics and how it affects our various different systems and elections. But we're going to kick off in topical style with a report from Emily on Super Tuesday, which happened last night, my time, I think everyone's time. So Emily, what happened?
Yes, coming at you not live from the United States. Here's a report on Super Tuesday. You know, as you know, we have the primary system. So states over the course of several months pick the Republican and Democratic candidates for president. And Super Tuesday, as the name suggests, has a bunch of states on one night. Trump and Biden were not surprisingly the big winners there. On the Democratic front, there were some, you know, we talked last week about Michigan and the uncommitted campaign. There were some other efforts that were sort of last minute that were, I would say, you know, effective at sending a message, but not as effective as the campaign in Michigan, which was much more sustained and focused, is what it looked like as an outsider. On the Republican side, the big winners, you know, Donald Trump, Nikki Haley did pick up her first state victory in Vermont. You might say, Emily, didn't she already win the Republican primary in the District of Columbia? Yes, she did. But sadly, we are not given statehood. It's taxation without representation. I did want to just flag a little bit of Trump's victory speech from Mar-a-Lago, where he complained about a lack of border security, about our policy toward China, about withdrawing from Afghanistan, and then said that the United States left behind jets and tanks and everything you can think of, goggles, night goggles. They didn't used to fight at night. Now they do because they have goggles. They have better goggles than we have. So it was a rambling speech, I think we can say, that did not mention Haley, that offered a very bleak vision of America at present, and I would argue a dystopian one of the future. And then, plot twist, Nikki Haley dropped out following Super Tuesday, which means that Trump is the only man left standing. She did not come out and endorse him. She said that he had to earn her supporters' votes. And then, of course, Biden put out a statement. Basically, he said Donald Trump made it clear he doesn't want Nikki Haley supporters. I want to be clear, there's a place for them in my campaign. And in fairness, those voters were important to Biden's victory in 2020. It's unclear how this will go down at this moment when he's sort of at odds with some elements of his own base. So Nikki Haley's out. Trump and Biden, I guess, you know, squaring off for Nikki Haley supporters. Mitch McConnell, unsurprisingly, came out and endorsed Donald Trump, which, you know, at the end of the day, it's still his party. One other thing that I wanted to flag for this week for our American politics watchers, this Thursday is the State of the Union. So Biden will speak to both houses of Congress. I'm really interested in, and I will be paying attention to sort of how he tries to package this moment, how he tries to sort of reconcile his Israel policy with the statements that he made for the first 2 years and some change of his presidency about, you know, marrying democracy and human rights and foreign policy and all of this. That will be Thursday, and I'll have a little, perhaps, if you're good, just kidding, I'll have a little update on that next week. But that's enough of that. We are now going to turn to our main subject today, which, as Tom said, is money in politics. And we are going to start with Rohan, who has a lot to say about money and the BJP. So Rohan, take it away.
Thanks, Emily. Yeah, the BJP, one of their big selling points has always been this idea that they're less or not corrupt compared to the Congress and the dynasty that came before them, and also the other dynastic and regional parties across India. And Modi came to power in 2014 on this big anti-corruption platform that over time became more openly Hindutva, or which is to say Hindu majoritarian over time, but it's still a big part of his whole argument that you can't ask questions of the BJP on the corruption side of things. One big source of corruption in India is political funding. It costs a lot to win elections. And so you have to accept money from someone to win them, and then you have to make some money to pay those people back often. And that's often how corrupt and illicit money enters Indian spaces. There was a study a couple of years ago that found that the 2019 election cost across parties' candidates $8.6 billion in India, which in the comparison was to about $11.1 billion spent in presidential and congressional elections in the US. So we're not at American levels, but it's not far off. And in 2017, the BJP decided to turn up and say, we've found a way to fix the problem of political corruption in India. They unveiled something called the Electoral Bond, which is kind of like a gift card or a voucher. They said, anyone who wants to can go buy an electoral bond from the State Bank of India, pick it up, and then go and hand it over to a political party of their choice. And by making this the primary way to fund our political parties, we are going to reduce corruption and black money and all that sort of thing. But there are two important bits to this. One, yes, that you had to go to the bank to do it. So you couldn't just be pulling money from out of your closet or under your mattresses. You had to go to a bank. And so it was less likely that this would be illicit cash that was untaxed at the very least. But the other side is that it would be completely anonymous. The BJP argued in front of the Supreme Court when this was challenged that Indian citizens have no right to know who is funding their political parties. There is no fundamental right to this. And they said that the only way we can really get people to actually use this is if we keep everyone's identity anonymous. The caveat to that anonymity is that the money was always flowing through the State Bank of India, which is run by the Indian government. And so the BJP, if it wanted to, could find out who was buying, who was getting the money, and would have this tremendous information asymmetry. This was back in 2017. It was challenged immediately in court, but the Supreme Court, which has not been very prompt on important matters in the last few years, took many, many years to actually listen to this. In the interim, we know that the BJP, through its own accounts, has received more than 50% of all the electoral bonds that were sold in the 6-7 years in between, more money than the other 30 parties combined. And again, we don't know that this is necessarily to do with the information asymmetry that they had or just because they are successful at this moment, but they were clearly the big winners of this new approach. The Supreme Court 2 weeks ago in India, in a surprising move that has become quite unusual from them in terms of acting as a check on the executive, struck it down saying that citizens do have a right to know who is funding political parties, that the BJP cannot claim that this is cleaning up the system, that we ought to be able to know who was spending this money, where it was going, and electoral bonds are no longer going to be a thing. So potentially going back to a system where, you know, again, there's illicit money going back into political parties and so on. But the important thing for those who don't know India too well, these two things. One was, it took 7 years for the Supreme Court to do this. And in that time, the BJP got this giant amount of money in their accounts and this advantage over everyone else. And the other is this approach. What I think was happening is that the BJP was hoping to move towards a more American-style system where money can be channeled through legal means, so to speak, through the banks, more of special interests rather than small, petty people, you know, donating money to parties, but do it in a way that gives them a giant advantage. And we're still going to have an extremely expensive election this year, and it'll be curious to see how that plays out. Is there chatter in either of your elections about the question of political funding? I feel like this was a big conversation in America a few years ago. I don't know the UK context at all on this.
Well, I'd like to hear from Tom first, because we were, just to give you guys a peek behind the curtain, we were talking about this before the podcast, and the UK is quite different from India and the United States in this regard. Like I had a lot of sympathy while Rohan was speaking. Obviously, it's not a one-to-one, but as I think many listeners will know, money plays a huge and controversial role in American politics, and it's quite different in the UK.
I mean, the sorts of sums of money that you two are talking about, or Ryan, you gave the figures for both the total India and total US election spend. And I know that both those countries are bigger, so they should be slightly bigger numbers, but they are just in a completely different league. They're just a different order of magnitude. At the last general election, which the Conservative Party won in the UK, they spent a total of £16 million on that successful election campaign. That was the biggest spend of any party. Total amount spent on the general election by the political party was probably in the region of about £40 million or so. That's not all the money that gets spent in politics all the time. There are staffing costs across the whole of all the time for all parties. There are things that people do outside of election campaigns. There are certain kinds of spend that aren't captured in that number. But nevertheless, we're just talking a piddling amount of money, which is nevertheless sometimes quite controversial. And people say we still have scandals around party donors. We still have complaints that the classic complaint is that the Tories are funded by rich billionaire businessmen and Labour are funded by trade union barons, both of which have a certain amount of truth to them and both of which are slightly misleading. But I must say, in an international context, the fundamental point there is that there's just no money at all. Now, why is that? Partly because there isn't a huge culture of either donating to political parties or soliciting donations to them, but also partly, I think, and really importantly, because of what you can spend the money on, of which the most important is that we don't allow TV advertising for during elections for political parties. Parties will make party election broadcasts, which they're given a slot for on the main broadcasters. They get a set number of slots to make a 4 or 5 minute little film, but they don't run commercials, and therefore there is nobody employed by Labour or Conservative HQ to do ad buying in different constituencies or different states, which is clearly, as you will know better than me, I'm certainly aware of that as being an enormous part of the US system, and is probably a pretty big part of the Indian system as well. Not just we don't run attack ads on our opponents on TV, we also don't run positive ads on TV. There are things that are changing a bit because some of the digital ads that the parties run are quite similar in style to some of the American style attack ads that you see, but the budgets for that are much smaller. So it's just a different kind of world. And I must say, I am much more comfortable living in a country where the numbers are so small. With the one caveat, I think, that because there's a relatively small number of political donors, and especially large political donors, you can have quite disproportionate influence. If you give a political party let's say, a six-figure sum, that makes you quite a big player. That doesn't mean that the parties will do as you say, because A, they might not want to, and B, parties wouldn't want to be seen to just do what their donors want. But nevertheless, there's no denying that the trade unions, not just because of the money they give, but because of historic links, but the trade unions just do have some influence on Labour Party policy. I mean, they're affiliated organisations. They have a formal role in the policymaking process. There's no question that significant Tory donors have an impact on how the Conservatives think about, you know, tax in particular, but potentially other issues. And there are plenty of examples of donors getting honours, either knighthoods and damehoods and so on, or in some cases going into the House of Lords. And you can always find a way of demonstrating that that's not why they're there. They're there for their services to something else. They're all distinguished people who've done something. But there's no question that being a party donor increases your influence. And in a world in which parties had to raise a massive amount more money, then I guess you would need more people in that situation. And it would be harder for individuals to claim that they have as much influence. But I'm not convinced that the money is out there in UK politics to raise that kind of money. My own personal view, which is not necessarily a popular one, is that I would rather take all private money out of UK politics and just have state-funded political parties. But that's a position that's relatively few people hold for reasons that aren't crazy, by the way.
Yeah, just to give people a sense of the difference in scale here, here is a headline from Politico from earlier this month. AIPAC, this is the American pro-Israel group, or one of the, it's a prominent pro-Israel group in the United States, uncorks $100 million war chest to sink progressive candidates. Now, this is just one group, right? This isn't, they're not even talking about the presidential election, right? They're talking about various congressional elections. So Tom just said that it's, what was the total number for the campaign? Like 40 million?
About 40 million,
right?
Give or take.
This is one group. And granted, it's a powerful group. And I just want to be clear. I don't mean that always when I'm speaking about pro-Israel or Jewish interest groups and money. I want to be clear that I'm not saying this in a nefarious conspiratorial way. I just mean that they are clearly a well-funded and influential group in American politics. But anyway, this is just one group, albeit a powerful and influential one. And we're not talking about the main race of the year, $100 million, per this political report. I would also say, I think in America, in the United States, it's sort of in some ways, not a race to the bottom, but it's hard to break out of the system. What I mean by this, you know, my first book is on George Soros and his influence and how he became such a powerful figure in politics, philanthropy, and finance, and why he's such an attractive boogeyman for some on the right. Prior to the election of 2004, he spoke out in favor of campaign finance reform. During the election of 2004, he believed that George W. Bush, should he be reelected, it would be such a threat to an open society, to American democracy, that he himself became a prominent Democratic Party donor. His son, when he took over as head of Open Society last year, said, basically, you know, we would rather that there's not going to be money in politics, but as long as there is, our side's going to do it too. Now, there are many on that side who say, good, right? Like, we don't want money out of politics. Just who cares about the principle? If one side's going to be really well funded and we're going to lose every election because there's no money, like, good. It's good that there's somebody pouring it into quote unquote our side. But on the other hand, it does, to me, it signifies how difficult it is to break the cycle in the United States and how little investment there is from the people who are actually political players in breaking it.
What always strikes me as incredible in the US is, I mean, the numbers you mentioned for AIPAC, even at the primary level, I mean, the sheer amount of money that people in primaries are spending. I think this is something we're not even there in India yet. I wonder what really drives. And of course, then the follow-up questions often like, what are these people necessarily getting out of it? And our assumption in India often was that what the BJP was seeking to do was moving towards a system where they have often spoken of formalizing the black money like economy in India. So taking money away from the untaxed parts of it, but opening up to what is seen, at least from the Indian side, as a more of a special interest type election in where the money is not black in the sense that it's taxed, it's not illicit, but there's still something unsavory about giant amounts of money going from corporations to political parties.
Whereabouts is the money coming from? I mean, I know I come from a world in which there isn't very much money and we do know roughly who's giving it, but who is it that is paying, you know, admittedly in a bigger country, who's paying all this money to political parties, other organizations that want to have a role in elections on a scale that dwarfs the UK by so much?
Well, I mean, in part, there are some very wealthy individuals. So because I mentioned Soros, I'll now mention that Peter Thiel is a billionaire who pretty famously backed the campaigns of Senate candidates, one of whom was successful, J.D. Vance of Ohio. Some were decidedly less successful. And Thiel said he was kind of like, oh, the people around him, oh, he's heterodox. He just picks interesting candidates. But if you looked, all of these people had very strong anti-immigrant, right-leaning platforms. In some cases, it's a really well-funded organization or lobbying group a very well-funded organization or PAC, a political action committee that's been working for years and has, in some case, those big donors, and in some case, a fundraising base. We should also say, though, that recently in American politics, there's been a push to get the money through small donors, And this sort of came about with, you know, not that it's all new or that it's all to him, but Bernie Sanders touted that the average donation in his campaign was quite low, that it was, you know, he was proud of the fact that it was a lot of small dollar donations that had been funding his campaign. So like, it's both incredibly powerful individuals, it's powerful organizations or groups. And then it's also people realizing like, oh, wait, this is a way that I can join the political system, right? And giving their money as well. So it's like, it's every level, it's every form.
Yeah. Is there a lobbying dimension as well? Because I mean, I know a little bit about political lobbying in the UK, and there are lots of criticisms attached to it, but money, donations to parties is just not part of that system at all.
Well, okay. So part of it is that you have like the non-political spending wing of these different groups, and then you have the political spending wing of the group, and they're separate, but like one doesn't need to be deeply cynical to say like, okay, these are not separate. They're connected, and you're spending money in one area to get the results that you want in another. For example, because I already mentioned them, we'll just stick with them as an example. There was a case where AIPAC came under a lot of heat for giving their endorsement to candidates who had voted not to certify the 2020 presidential election results. And their response was basically like, we aren't nonpartisan. We endorse candidates from across the political spectrum. The criticism was like, you are endorsing candidates who voted against our democracy because you think that they will vote a certain way on the issue that matters to you. I interviewed former Congressman Andy Levin when he was running in his primary campaign that he ultimately lost. And his response to this was like, I've got news for you. When we're not a democracy anymore, you're not going to be able to lobby, which I think is actually a really interesting point given the stakes of this upcoming election and given that we have a candidate who did not accept the previous election results, who may not in the future if he is reelected to that office. So the like defense of money in politics, perhaps not as much as we have in the United States, but the defense of money in politics is that like it shouldn't all be state-owned and state-backed, and that people outside of the halls of power, the formal halls of power, should be able to have a say in elections as well. And perhaps you cap it so that it's not like so few people have such a giant thumb that they can put on the scale, but it's a way of making sure that it's not just smoke-filled rooms. You know, it's not just the political hacks or whatever you want to call it, bargaining as to who gets to be in charge. You have to have other stakeholders involved. You have to listen to people other than yourselves. But it ends up being the criticism of that defense ends up being, okay, well, you've just replicated smoke-filled rooms with a different way in. And further, that if that ends up putting into power a fundamentally anti-democratic group or a group that is not disposed to democracy, then what did all your money get you? Am I making sense?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about transparency, because in UK politics, we don't know about small donors, but we know quite a lot about anyone who gives more than, I think, £7,500. That was the level last time I checked. All those people are on a register and you can look them up and find out who they are. I think a similar situation applies in the States, but I'm not quite sure whether in India you know where the money is coming from. Is there a similar sort of set of system of transparency there as well?
Yeah, that was essentially what they were attempting to do here, that until a certain point, you had to report if you gave over 20,000 rupees, a piddling amount. The government actually brought that down to 2,000 rupees, saying that anyone over 2,000 rupees needs to put their name to it. But the way parties just deal with this is they say one person gave 100 tickets, so to speak, of 2,000 rupees versus just 10 of 20,000 and so on. It's very easy to deal with it. The heartening side of it maybe is that I can't remember the exact who did this research a few years ago, but someone looked at officially stated payment amount that was spent on campaigns. Now, again, official and unofficial in India could be wildly different, but looking at the official amount of money spent on various campaigns and found, to a large extent, no correlation between throwing more money at an election and winning, which is maybe heartening. I don't know. I don't know if it just encourages more and more money going down that drain or not, but at least suggests that like that that alone is not going to turn an election. But at the same time, what we've seen in the last 10 years is that the disparity between the two national parties, the BJP and the Congress, and then another, is so big that even if at an individual election level it doesn't make a difference, for all the things that happen in between and being able to create your image and creating a sense of doing attacks and so on, there's definitely bound to be some impact that we are not able to fully study or research well enough. But yeah, maybe it's just a good thing that that alone can't predict outcomes.
Yeah, and I mean, you do have stories like this as well, right? Where like, this candidate outspent us 5-1, but we still won because we have people power. Like, sure, that does happen. And Tom, to your point, like, yes, it is all supposed to be transparent, but you do have stories where it's like people sort of find that the guy behind the, you know, like, okay, this is not exactly about elections, but it's sort of like the way in which over the course of, I think last year, it was discovered that billionaire Harlan Crow was like paying for all these undisclosed trips for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and like had bought his mother's house. And I mean, I would argue that this is not money in politics. This is just corruption, but it describes a phenomenon that we've seen before, which is like, huh, okay, well, this wasn't actually disclosed. And it turns out that you have all of these ties to this extremely rich person who is influencing you in perhaps ways that are not clear just looking at, you know, the little form that you submitted at the end of the campaign or the end of the term or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, we do have occasional scandals or attempted scandals in the UK around, you know, this donation was made in this person's name, but actually maybe she's just being a proxy for her husband who, for legal reasons, doesn't have the right to donate in the UK. And how do we know who gave it? Those things come up every now and then, although in American terms, they're always over very small sums of money.
Rohan, I just want to ask you one final question before we head to our premium segment, which is, basically, have you noticed a difference this election? It just seems like, as an outsider, and maybe this is too dark a read, but it just seems like this election, the BJP is really solidifying its hold on political power in India. Has that been accompanied by like a tighter grip on money in politics or a change in money in politics? Basically, do you see a difference in money in politics this election?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what the immediate outcome of or the impact of the Supreme Court's decision will be in the short run for this election. The Supreme Court also announced that State Bank of India needs to publicly name who bought and donated these electoral bonds. But of course, the bank has gone to court this week and said, could you give us 3 months to do that? And so they're not going to put that information out likely, unless the Supreme Court really goes after them until after the election. Among the things that have happened recently, to answer your question, is that the Income Tax Department sent a notice to the Congress party saying it had not paid tax appropriately and attempted to confiscate something like, It's unclear to me exactly, something like 200 crore. I'm always very bad. I need to work on this in terms of how much that means in dollars or pounds, but a large amount of money to freeze it up and to do that again right before a general election, even if they have cause for it, it's really a complex thing in terms of using muscle power to go after the limited monetary resources of your opposition. At the same time, they're spending a huge amount. The News Minute and News Laundry, two news independent news organizations, had recent reports of trying to match cases where investigative agencies, particularly the ED, the Enforcement Directorate, which does financial crime in India, launched cases against companies for various reasons. And then they found that those companies would then go and buy these electoral bonds and donate to the BJP soon after. Or we think they donated to the BJP because it was anonymous. So there's indications, it's still fairly opaque, there's indications that the BJP has built up things over the last 10 years and is using them. They've also been spending a huge amount. YouTube has become really the home of a lot of the spending this year. And they've spent more in the last month than they did in the 4 months before the elections in 5 years ago. And so, you know, online, it's just plastered, as well as in newspapers and on TV, plastered with Modi and the BJP everywhere. So they're flexing their muscles both in spend and presumably behind the scenes from what we know.
We have to leave it there for this main segment. If you are a premium listener, that means if you pay to listen to this podcast, just stick with us for one moment while we say goodbye to the rest of our friends. Friends, thank you so much for joining us this week. We appreciate it. We're still a new podcast, so we would really appreciate it if you like, subscribe, leave a review, nice review, tell your friends, tell your haters and your motivators. Thank you for joining us. We will talk to you next week.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.